Either. Okay, we're ready now.
My friends in the plastics department found that if they copolymerized one of these ethers with tetrafluoroethylene, it gave them a good, stable, processable plastic. And when we heard that, we asked them if they would please give us the monomer and let us see if we could make a decent elastomer, and they did. McGrew got me some. Perforce, he was good about it. So we just pursued that line and managed to pump a lot of perfluoromethyl vinyl ether, which turned out to be the best one, into TFE and made a good-looking rubber that was utterly unvulcanizable. And then by the end of blood, sweat, and tears, many years' work, we finally found co-monomers that we could put in there that were adequate for curing purposes, the best of which was one that Dexter Patterson uncovered. There were a whole bunch of them that worked, but that was the best one. It was a perfluorophenyl. Perfluorophenoxy, perfluoropropyl, oxy, perfluorovinyl ether. Not too good a name, but you get the idea. Using that, we were able to make a vulcanizates which had stability all the way from the point at which they had flexibility about minus 10 Celsius up to the point of their thermal decomposition, which was just about the same as Teflon, around 325 C. The real problem we had here was not the rubber itself, but how to develop it. It was so expensive and hard to develop that we had to take the unusual course of deciding to market it ourselves as finished articles, because the major market that we thought we had disappeared when Congress refused to support the SST any further. So we floated a little business in the laboratory, and that was fun. Other than starting the project, that was my contribution, was saying the only way we can make money out of this is if we make the articles ourselves. And it worked.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a fantastic rubber. A small business. Departmental management laughed at it, but God bless my friend Harrington. He said, "Let him do what he wants. Give him the money." And Holmes' sales was furious. The salespeople were out in the field were furious because we were competing with them, but they let us get started. And they even gave us people to help us, like Ralph Graff.
Well, you weren't really competing against conventional Viton.
Well, our customers thought we were, and our salespeople thought we were. Mm-hmm. But this was so much better than Viton, it wasn't.
Mm-hmm.
But the real point was that our customers wanted to make all the money. And if there was any juice in this, it had to be in selling the articles. And there was no way we could justify all the research expense and all the manufacturing expense to sell what would be at the most a few thousand pounds of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You couldn't charge enough for it. What it amounted to was selling it as a raw polymer. We could maybe get $100 a pound for it. It had a value in use down an oil well or in an SST of anywhere from $1,000 to $10,000 a pound. We sold the armed services $60,000 worth of Calres as material. This will make it very clear. We stopped doing this except for the armed services. $60,000 worth of material. It saved them $50 million in retrofitting the Titan rockets.
Is that right?
Yeah. $50 million.
They came back to you with information about how they'd used it?
Or? Oh, yeah. We knew we knew what they were using it for.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. SEALs where Viton had failed.
Uh-huh.
And so except for outlets like that, we had a special deal with the government where we give it to them for a reasonable price and let them use it for them. But all the other things, we chose to go after ourselves.
Yes.
It was really funny to see how quickly the front office attitude changed when some like the third or fourth year into this development, we made $1 million profit out at the lab.
Maybe that explained the change of philosophy that began to seep into Central Research about that time, because we were criticized for not having gotten involved enough in the marketplace and actually dealing with end users, customers. That was probably part of your study committee's...
Partly. Yeah, it could be.
On Central Research.
One very strong, influential factor in Central Research that may have been even stronger was Monroe Sadler. Mm. Central Research was always a conflict between the theoretical science Cairns and the very savvy practical guy Sadler.
Mm-hmm.
And they stuck partly as a result of this study committee, and some one of our recommendations was for the development department to get the hell back and work on the Central Research Department. They did merge the appropriate portions and stuck Sadler back in Central Research. But I just don't know. Those forces are hard to analyze. They're so complicated. But you got to give Monroe an awful lot of credit for this force.
Well, maybe we'll come back later and talk about Monroe and some of your other colleagues and peers.
Yeah.
In fact, I think we'll pause here and set a later date for to finish off with some people and personalities and philosophy.
All right. Yes, sir. Thank you.
This is Raymond C. Ferguson at Herman Schroeder's house in Greenville, his home, where continuing the interview started December 30th. This is January 12th in the morning. Well, Herman, you we were talking about some errors you spotted in the little printout I gave you, so is there something you want to...
Well, it's not... There's nothing really, mostly other than just misspellings, things like that. And one, let me turn these over. One, I can't quite remember how Harvey Hain got in when I'm talking about Pappenheimer and Adams, Conant and Bolton and Gerasi. I was wondering if there's somebody else that should be.
You mean other than Harvey Hain?
Yeah.
No, I had mentioned Harvey.
Yeah, okay, fair enough.
Yeah.
I thought maybe that was the case.
Yeah. Well,
I got on to Harvey early because I used to take him to work when he first came to the station, yeah.
I guess I remember we talked a bit about Harvey at lunch the other day.
Yeah. On page 8 here, there's something that puzzles me. You have Mr. Wietrich, of the Edgemore plant, and I can't figure out who that is.
He's a person I know, and I thought you might have known that. I raised his
okay,
name.
Okay, okay, okay. Fine enough. Fair enough.
He was involved in the Apollo signing process at Edgemore.
Yeah, okay. Fair enough. I just forget. You did a good job of putting this. Gosh, we've got down a lot of garbage here.
It's all interesting, Herman.
Oh, sure, sure. Well, some of it's good and some of it isn't.
Well, we discussed Adaprene, Nitrile, Vitol, Viton, Nordel, and Calrez. I didn't say anything specifically about Vamac. Do you want to add anything about that?
Actually, I think most of what you need on Vamac you'll find in that Goodyear paper. It's a short summary, but Vamac was interesting in that we'd made a rather interesting discovery that you could copolymerize ethylene and functional monomers like acrylic acids and acrylonitrile esters, in the presence of a Lewis acid, of which we picked fluoroboric acid because it was recoverable, and this gave us a beautiful alternating copolymer, which had an extraordinary combination of reasonable solvent resistance and good temperature and oxidation resistance. Sort of a carefully engineered compromise to meet a perceived market gap. And we were quite enthusiastic about it until we ran some calculations. I was worried about the process, and we ran some calculations, and to make that stuff, we would have had to invest about $80 million in plant to make 50 million pounds of it. And there was no way we were going to make a gamble like 80 million pounds on that kind of a product. And I remember here I exerted what you might call executive privilege. I told the guys to knock it off. Let's find a practical way to make this polymer rather than make such a fancy thing. Let's go make it down in one of the Texas plants where they know how to copolymerize ethylene, even if it isn't so perfect. And that produced wails from my colleagues, Bert Anderson and Rudy Pariser. But faced with the lack of funds, they had to do it. And we very quickly got Vamac, which was practically as good as this beautiful alternating polymer. It just wasn't as scientifically nice.
I see.
Yeah.
You brought up a point that I've been thinking about. Perhaps you'll mention it. It seemed to me over the years I lost lots of cases where it was extremely hard to turn a research project.
Oh, it's terrible.
Even though it wasn't going
well. Terrible, yeah.
Who finally has to decide this? You?
Well, if I have the good sense to see it, I usually have to do it myself, yeah, because it's very hard to separate the scientist from his child. And you can understand that.
Oh, yes, yes.
I stopped a number of them. Pete Goffinet was pursuing two very interesting processes for making Nordel. One a new solution process, and the other with evaporative cooling and all kinds of stuff. Beautiful, the one we now use. And the other, a potentially cheaper, but much more gambly suspension process. Now, we just didn't have the money or energy or people to pursue those both on the scale that would ensure getting the thing done. And I told Pete we had to pick one of them. And he thrashed and fumed and kicked. And I said, well, finally, when I couldn't get him to make up his mind, I brought him into the office and said, Pete, pick a process. If you don't pick it, I'll pick it. You know, and he picked it. Then he picked it, yeah. And you have to do things like that.
Was the slurry process?
Well, the slurry process is the one we killed.
Oh, I see.
And slurry or suspension, yeah, that's the one we killed. We just didn't have enough manpower to do it, or the money to do them both. It's like going to the store and wanting to buy two suits when you got enough money for one.
Yes.
There are a lot of cases like that. There was a fascinating one with Pariser, where just it shows the psychology in situations like this. There was a project he was pursuing that obviously was going around and around in circles, and I won't identify the chemist, it's immaterial. But the fellow just was on the head of a pin and he wasn't going to get off it. But Rudy loved the project, so I said, Rudy, we got to stop it. It's not getting us anywhere. And after much storm and drong, my telling Rudy we're going to knock out the funds, he said, okay, we'll stop it. Then I did something that was inspired because I said, Rudy, write me a little letter summarizing this discussion. So Rudy wrote me the letter. And we theoretically stopped the project. And I went back to my office. 3 months later, I was out there talking about the project again. And there was this damn project going along full steam and getting nowhere at the same speed. So I said, Rudy, we agreed to stop that one. And he says, no, we didn't. You approved it last time. So I had my files with me. I whipped this letter out. And I showed it to Rudy, and he looked at it. He was absolutely stunned, and he says, I never wrote it. It just shows you how you get fixed on these things.
Maybe interjecting something in politics. I can remember Rudy got extremely frustrated at one time about Chestnut Run never making up their mind on testing a product candidate. Does that ring a bell with you?
It was difficult to get them to accept a new product. The real reason here is in their psychology. They test products that we market and decide whether they're good enough, and they also look at external products and try to compare them with ours, and their general approach to things is to try to show that things aren't adequate. I mean, that's just the way they're geared, to try to make the plant make better stuff or try to show the outside stuff is not as good as the homemade stuff. So when you send them something from the laboratory, the way they go at it is what's wrong with it. And when they're faced with a situation where the product is different but better, it presents them with an agonizing decision, so they can't make up their minds. Enough?
Yeah. We may have, unless there's some other things you wanted to mention about your polymer career or the polymer business.
You could go on and talk forever.
Yeah, right. You had a patent on a cordless vehicle tire. Did this patent ever go anywhere?
No, there were... Actually, there were two of those.
Well, yes. Yeah.
One on Hytrel and one on urethanes. In each case, those were defensive patents to protect ourselves. We were engaged in a couple of secrecy agreements with other companies where they were pursuing technologies using our products. And these were thrown into the pot as ways of being sure that specific coverage would be devoted to the use of our products as we wanted them to be used in tires, in one case with Hytrel and the other case with polyurethanes. The company with whom we were engaged in the secrecy agreement would have had access to these patents. It was just defensive.
Well, do you want to talk a bit about your consulting career?
I'd like to talk about the research organization and the philosophy of running research a little bit. Now, we can do that after or later, whichever you like.
It's something I'd like to hear about.
As I ambled through Central Research, chemical department, and saw the way they ran research, some of which I didn't like, too empirical and too imitative of hot stuff that was going on outside, and then saw the way I was handled in Jackson Laboratory and what worked and what didn't work. When I got to Jackson Laboratory, I was left alone. They just told me, do what I want, pretty much. Take care of this project, but do what you want. And that was very good. What I developed was a strong conviction that to run a research organization, you have to control things to be sure that the train goes in the direction you want it to go. But the looser you can leave the reins, the better. And this, of course, depends upon the character of all the individuals who are doing the work. The really able ones, you just forget about them. The ones who need to be directed, you direct them. And the ones that need too damn much direction, you get rid of them. You have to, because you haven't got the time to spend with them. And as a result of this, when we set up our new department, the Elastomer Chemicals Department, we tried to set things up so that there was a minimum number of layers between the chemist doing the work and us in Wilmington, and so that we had a chance to listen directly to what the research man thought he was going to accomplish. I'd been in a world where my bosses were always making the promises about what I was going to accomplish. And this often had no connection with reality. They didn't understand the science, or they didn't really understand what you could accomplish. So we set up an organization where the chemists were writing down what they could accomplish, and the division heads could say whatever they wanted to say separately. But we had there what the chemist thought he could do. And this, of course, caused the supervisors to gnash their teeth because they lost some kind of control they wanted. But it gave us a much better feel for what we were going to accomplish. And it stimulated the fellows because they had a hell of a lot more personal responsibility for what they were doing. And on top of that, we really encouraged them to spend a significant amount of their time in freewheeling, trying to find new things to do and to really, really get to think. We also set up the maximum number of contacts, reviews, and the like that we could tolerate with the scientists, so that they again have a chance to talk about what they were doing and we could talk with them directly. And we did all we could to stimulate them to accomplishment by getting them to publish and trying to get them to patent things. This is why I set up those, I don't know, you got to some of my special lunches, didn't you?
Yes.
And I had a similar thing for patents. Only since patents were really what we're supposed to get, I set up a fancy dinner for the patent people and got the management in and say, now look, these are our heroes. These are the fellows who got us the patents. And I used to tell them about the people who did the publishing. And the result of all this is a much better, greater feeling of esprit de corps, interaction between the scientists and the management, and feeling of great participation. So we had hellishly good morale compared to most of the other research divisions. And the other effect of this is we were extraordinarily productive by any count that the people in the patent part of the company kept. We were knocking out patents at a rate 3 to 4 times those per man than most of the other research divisions. I'm violently against the kind of regimented society that is presently in place in DuPont, where all your goals are so carefully set that each fella has no time, except possibly in central research.
Well, even there's an element of the research by objectives. I think it's interesting. I mean, you sense they felt the same way I did about this. I saw developing in the 70s and 80s, plastics department seemed to be the role model for the company.
Yeah.
Rather than the elastomers. That may have been happening, but I think that was beginning to happen perhaps even before you retired.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
But in my view, they weren't contributing as much in the way of new innovations.
No, they weren't. They weren't at all.
I think a lot of what happened to the plastics department may have been competitive pressures. Being in a commodities type of environment more.
It's quite complex. It partly is in the character of their management, and partly it comes from a historical development. A conflict grew up in plastics between. After John Beakley retired as research director and McGrew became research director, McGrew was a very capable man, but he was very arrogant and he kind of worked by fiat. He did what he damn pleased, too much, and he completely ignored his management and he made all kinds of promises that he couldn't come through with. He overblew his accomplishments and he overspent. So it was a case of excess. He got into a bit of a to-do with Roy Schuyler when Roy was head of one of the manufacturing, one of the businesses, and he got to treating Roy like a pile of dirt. All of a sudden, one morning, Roy was his boss, and within a week, McGrew was on his way to Geneva. They trumped up a job for him. Well, this built up a kind of a spirit in that department, who kicked the hell out of the research division. I'm sorry to tell you some of this, but it gives you a little feel for...
Sure. I always knew there were There were office politics and personality conflicts and so on, but it's interesting to hear.
Yeah.
How about some of the research leaders, say, of other departments? What did you did you know Hale Church well?
Yeah, I knew Hale pretty well. Hale was a very able fella. Hale's going to be covered in good detail in that book that Hounshell's putting out. Mm-hmm. And it's silly to waste time on it because he's more than covered in there.
Okay, fine.
What you got with the research directors is the same sort of thing you get with any group of people. If you get enough, there are good ones and poor ones, and you get some semblance of a distribution, mm-hmm. a probability, you know. Excuse me.
Well, I know that you want to talk about some of your DuPont colleagues, since we're already sort of into that, or I was going to ask you about your colleagues and some consultants.
Yeah, okay. Sure, go ahead. Go ahead, sure.
We're just at the end.
You want to stop here? Go ahead.